Hello, and welcome to the Sequin Playbill, the podcast shining a spotlight on live theater and drag culture, brought to you by Raven S. Claw. Today's episode, we explore the use of drag within live theater. Oh my god, she's back! Yes, Raven S. Claw here, back giving you more podcasting goodness under the newly rebranded Riesling and Raven, now called the Sequin Playbill, which is going to focus solely on drag and theater related topics. So I'll be covering topics and things like shows coming to Broadway in 2023, female-forward shows and songs and solos. I'll be covering the use of drag within film, the history of drag, which is kind of going to be included in this episode. I'll be discussing songs about love, LGBT musicals, drag from around the world, and really just trying to help spread the knowledge and the connection between live theater and drag, and kind of explain what it is that drag is for me and a lot of the rest of our community who use drag for many reasons. So, to get started, I think the beginning is a very good place to start. So, a lot of people would typically assume that, well, it's not common knowledge, but for those of us who do know, it is pretty much common knowledge that people would say that drag started in Shakespearean times because women weren't allowed to perform in live theater. Again, heteronormative cis men having a tight grip on an industry, not new. But women were not allowed to perform in live theater, so men would play the roles of females, and they would wear makeup, they would wear wigs, they would have dresses on, and that was from Shakespearean time. But it was the use of men playing women was happening way back in ancient Greece. Like, in Greek society, women were considered vastly inferior to men and unfit for the stage. One of the society's most respected art forms was theater. So female roles were played by men. Not even this complete absence of women in theater offers a portrait of the culture of the time, however. Both Plato and Socrates worried about the damaging effects of male actors degrading themselves by representing female emotions and characteristics. That is basically the summary that I found on Playbill.com when they posted their article on drag within theater. I'll be mentioning back to that article a lot because the way that they summarized it was, it isn't a terrible summary of drag in theater, but there are, some elements that they didn't quite, mention. Especially with modern drag, they completely left out an element that influenced drag heavily to what it is today. But yeah, so back to the article that they mentioned. They mentioned, with all the dynamic female roles in Shakespeare, it's hard to believe this great oeuvre was once the exclusive domain of men. In Elizabethan times, women had limited freedom or social status and could not participate in any professional discipline, including theater. Adolescent boys played the female roles, perhaps looking somewhat plausible in women's clothing, with their less broad shoulders, softer faces, and diminutive height. The audiences of the time were able to suspend their disbelief, but you have to imagine the world didn't see the greatest Lady Macbeth, Cleopatra, or Juliet until years later when women were cast in the parts. So back then, obviously, they would have young boys playing women. And it's ironic to think about now because thinking about the play Peter Pan, now we have a woman playing an adolescent boy. And now it's almost like a staple that you have a woman playing Peter Pan because it's like a lead role that is so heavy that I don't think people would think that a young male actor would be able to do that show and hold that role and be able to pull it off for as long and as professionally as an adult woman. So they basically, it's not permanently casted, but it's expected casting for a woman to play the role of Peter Pan in today's theater, like a boy would be cast as a woman back in the Elizabethan times. Just an interesting connection that I just noticed. And then they go on to discuss kabuki. So in Japan, kabuki actually began as a female-only discipline, but in the 16th century, women were banned from performing, and so a new all-male kabuki was born. In both cases, kabuki was a common form of mass entertainment, including erotic titillation, even to the point where the performers, female and later male, were available for hire as prostitutes after the show. Later, as Japan opened up to the West, there was a movement to legitimize kabuki with more respect among the upper classes and solidify its place as an indigenous art amidst all the cultural integration. The success of these efforts assured the lasting legacy of kabuki in modern Japan, now open up to women in some companies. So, I am not quite familiar with the style of kabuki theater, but a lot of parallels that I'm noticing between theater. When I did my research and I looked up a lot of things, I noticed a lot of parallels between the theater world and the average everyday world and everyday life. And it's just so entertaining, the idea that drag is seen as such a outlandish thing, that it's so abnormal, and yet it is probably one of the oldest art forms besides music or paintings. Like, music, visual art, and theater are the oldest art forms that I could even that I can think of. Like, the idea of paintings on cave walls. Wow, that was not English. The idea of paintings on cave walls, smacking sticks against hides and skins stretched over wood hoops, creating drums and music, and the idea of using your voice to create notes and sounds and singing, and then to use the idea of a campfire and the shadows on a wall, and you would play out characters like animals or hunting scenarios and creating theater. It's all so ancient and old art forms that people are so dismissed by nowadays, and it's just baffling to think about. So moving back to the article where it moves on to Western opera, it discusses Western opera. There are traditions of cross-gender casting for both directions. Some female roles were played by men, either countertenors, men who sing in a middle female or alto range, or sopranists, men who sing in a higher female or soprano range. At times, these roles were played by castrati, or men who were neutered before adolescence so as to preserve their prepubescent feminine-sounding voices. Interesting. Less extreme, but more unique to opera, has been the existence of pants roles, male parts played by women, such as Cherubino in The Marriage of Figaro, and Hansel in Hansel and Gretel. Perhaps due to the heightened reality of operatic music, this type of reverse casting has been generally accepted by audiences for centuries. In Chinese opera, there is even a history of female impersonators as the greatest stars of the stage, more notably Mei Lunfang, who toured the world in the early 20th century, performing for Hollywood stars and heads of state, and who is said to have influenced Brecht and Stanislavski. So, needless to say, there are still some elements of classical theater that we don't continue to do, which is good and shows progress, but there is still progress to be made even by today's standards. Then we move to the Victorian era. It was during the Victorian era that the term drag is believed to have been coined, as the long and heavy skirts of the day literally dragging along the stage. This occurred, however, alongside a transition from more presentational styles of performance to the naturalistic world of playwrights like George Bernard Shaw and Oscar Wilde, two playwrights who I am absolutely in love with. In which actors generally portrayed characters of their own gender. Theater flourished as political and economic stability made for safe nighttime passage, and shows were able to run for a long time. Eventually, though, this era of theater gave birth to arguably the most famous example of cross-gender casting, the title role in Peter Pan, a male part audiences not only accept played by a woman, but is expected to be played by a woman. So yeah, that touches back on the idea of women playing very young boy roles and young boys playing female roles earlier on. But this is where, in the article, they completely leave out an element of influence of drag. Well, okay, so this is where it leaves out a very heavy influence in drag, but drag in the sense of bars and clubs and what drag culture is today. It leaves out a very heavy mention of the ballroom scene in the 80s. Paris is Burning. I'll touch on that in a bit. But yeah, so this is where the article diverges from the influence of external influences in impacting drag and what it is today and what it means to be a drag queen today. But continuing along, while still a vibrant aspect of some theater, drag has also evolved into an art form unto itself. If 20th century queer men and women experimented with cross-dressing to express their individuality apart from traditional society and their solidarity with each other, the inherent presentational nature of drag made for a slippery slope between performance and offstage life, with generations of drag kings, queens walking that line, each to their own unique fashion. Some of those artists have identified and come out as transgender, while for others it has been just playing a character. For some, it's a character, but one they don't take off, challenging society at times with the open rebellion against traditional gender roles. Since the beginning of the LGBT liberation movement and the 1969 uprising at the Stonewall Inn, drag has been closely linked to political action as it has been to entertainment. As the years go on, this line includes to be blurred. Wait, what? No, this line continues to be blurred. Did I say that? I don't know. RuPaul began his career as a counterculture fringe artist alongside Lady Bunny and numerous other Alphabet City denizens of the 80s, but today hosts one of the most successful reality competitions on TV, a show business phenomenon that surely educates many people otherwise unfamiliar with aspects of LGBT culture. It does I think it more just opens the door to the entirely diverse and slightly complicated nature that is the LGBT community. It's not, we are basically a community built up on life is not black and white. That is basically what our entire community stands on. And I think the show is more of a door to opening that culture to the world. And it's basically up to the individual whether they walk through that door and openly learn about the community, or if they close the door behind them and turn the opposite direction. But it continues to also follow on. Murray Hill is a drag king known as the hardest working middle-aged man in show business. As a fixture of downtown New York nightlife, you'll find Hill all around town at all hours, always in a suit and tie, on or off stage. Broadway, television, and cabaret star comedian Leah DeLaria says she is often confused for Hill, although DeLaria proudly identifies not as male, but as a butch dyke. DeLaria has played men through in the Rocky Horror Picture Show as Lil Abner. DeLaria explores all these colors of expression on her new album, House of David, offering a fresh perspective on the music and on the music of landmark rock and roll gender bender David Bowie. Yeah, see, I would also, like, I would include, like, icons like David Bowie or Lady Gaga or, but, like, pop icons that play with that idea of gender and play with masculine elements and feminine elements and, like, don't just come off through a screen as one thing. They ebb and flow and blur the lines, and it's a stem from theater, and I love it. Oh, and then we follow on to Glenn Milstead became a star as Divine in many John Waters' seminal works in the 70s and 80s. Each film was like a movie within a movie, wherein Milstead played Divine, playing a character. He even released music as Divine, and yet he lived as a man. A new play, Divine / Intervention, is currently exploring its dichotomy in the New York International Fringe Festival. Divine's legacy continued years later on Broadway when Hairspray became one of the biggest hit musicals of the 2000s, with Harvey Fierstein and then a long line of men in the role of Edna Turnblad. While Fierstein is a versatile actor long associated with drag in various permutations, many of the actors to take on Edna have been novices to the genre, gender be damned. Maybe it's just a character like any other. On the other hand, there is a statement being made somewhat subtly in a man playing Edna. It expands the horizons of the show's message about social acceptance, racial integration, etc. Similarly, in Off-Broadway's Ruthless, a man plays the role of Sylvia St. Croix, adding an irony to an already pointed depiction of traditional middle-class America. So that is basically a summary of the article Playbill posted about drag in theater. But, like I said, they completely left out an element of what drag is today, versus drag when it was strictly in theater, pre-1950s, I guess, maybe 1960s, stuff started to change, but the biggest change that happened within drag as a entertaining art form is it's moved into clubs, and it's inspired heavily by the ballroom culture. The ballroom culture, in short, is a culture created by LGBT people of color who didn't have a place to go, who weren't safe being out and about where they lived. They were shunned from homes, kicked out of homes. They were beaten, attacked. They were targeted. And it was a lot of trans POCs. There is a documentary I highly encourage everybody to watch called Paris is Burning. And it covers a lot of what ballroom culture is, and it's basically about ball culture. And you can see, while watching the documentary, you can see the elements of what drag is today present in what ballroom culture is. There are elements of, like, the language from ball culture within drag. The, like, personalities and the energy and the, just the overall atmospheres within drag shows are very much that of what balls were back in the 80s through 60s, or 70s and 80s. And there's just a lot of, recently there's been a very large uptick in drag performers that are getting into drag for the performative elements and the idea of being able to go on a stage and be a character. And it's amazing to see the uptick of people being able to explore their gender and be themselves on the stage, but at the same time don't know where, like, they don't know where everything that they're saying and doing comes from. And I think there should be, like, not a class, but, like, a SparkNote video on, well, I mean, there probably is, but people just don't put in the effort or energy to actually look it up. The knowledge of where drag came from compared to what it is today. Like, what is it that queens do today that were massive elements of what was happening in ball culture? And it's a handful of years, people have been, like, trying to tear down the all ages drag events because they think that it's not appropriate for children and that it's almost trying to condition and, like, groom children to be this quote-unquote woke society, which, if woke means being, like, if woke means being more knowledgeable and understanding of the human experience from other perspectives and garnering a respect for others as human beings, then great. Call me woke, whatever the frick you want. But the amount of hate that people are starting to spew just because they don't understand something and they're under preconceived notions that what drag is a certain way and that it's not able to change. Like, I do drag, like, I've done drag brunches, I've done all ages events, and I adjust my drag and my persona and my numbers for the demographic of the audience. I have done a family event and I have done just Disney villain numbers because it's Disney and it's family fun. And then when I go and I do my nightclub stuff and I do my 19 plus events, then I will get into the adult content. Like, if we aren't explicitly doing our adult numbers for family events, like, is that not common sense? Do people not think that we don't know what we're doing? Like, it's just baffling to me. Anyways, getting, where was I? Right, okay, so there's also, so there's this conversation that's been going around about men presenting as female in drag being used solely for comedic elements in theater, whereas females presenting as male drag is simply looked over. And the idea of using crossing genders for casting opposite character genders is always used for either villain roles or for comedic elements. Yes, I already know there are roles where it isn't for either, and it is for genuineness, but I've gone through some of the shows, and I've actually discovered what it is that differentiates one from the other. So, the following roles are... Okay, I'm gonna just go through this set of roles and see if you can figure out the connection. Edna Turnblad in Hairspray, Mary Sunshine in Chicago, Sylvia St. Croix in Ruthless, Miss Trunchbull in Matilda, and Lady Hyacinth Dysquith from A Gentleman's Guide to Love and Murder. All of those roles are men portraying women, and it's all for, like, a villain role like Miss Trunchbull, or a comedic role like Edna in Hairspray. And all of those roles, it's never mentioned that it's a man. It is played through that the man is pretending to be a woman on the stage for comedic elements. Now, the next set of roles are Lola from Kinky Boots, Hedwig from Hedwig and the Angry Inch, Albin or Zaza from La Cage aux Folles, Bernadette Baysinger from Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, or Angel Chouinard from Rent. Those roles are... Well, Angel is actually a transgendered woman, and Hedwig is also a transgendered woman. But those are all roles that aren't just meant for comedy elements, but their character's personality and bio is heavily influenced by the idea of them having been born male and now present differently. A lot of them are drag characters, other than the two that are trans women, but unless it's explicitly mentioned, or it's like, it's been those, the second set of characters and whatnot are specifically their personality is their gender identity. That's basically what it's come down to. And then the first set are men presenting as women, but solely for the comedic element. There is no genuine male acting as a woman with wholehearted, like, it's just a male playing a female character. There is no, like, aspect of that gender play as the root of the character's personality, and it's not for a comedic or villainy element. Recently, which I hope this is going to be the start of something new with casting opposite genders and whatnot, but Jinx Monsoon is cast as Mama Morton in Chicago. And this is probably one of my favorite things that I've heard in a while within theater, and I'm hoping that Jinx plays it straight. I mean, Jinx's identity is gender fluid, so Jinx playing Mama as a woman, as a non-binary actor, where the gender identity is not the character's personality. And watching Chicago, I don't see the antagonist as Mama. I mean, I know many are probably going to disagree, but when I watch the show and I learn and I do and I go through the music and I listen to the dialogue and everything about Mama, I don't feel Mama is the antagonist that is preventing the protagonist from succeeding in her goal and whatnot. I mean, there are elements and hints here and there, but I feel like the... I'm getting sidetracked, actually, now that I'm starting to get into that. But, again, Jinx playing Mama in Chicago, I hope, opens the door for men genuinely playing female roles wholeheartedly, authentically, and honestly, and earnestly, rather than constantly being kind of pigeonholed into the villain or the comedic relief roles. And the same thing goes for women being able to play male characters and not just young boys. Like, they did have that in Hedwig and the Angry Inch, and I think it was the step in the right direction, and I hope Jinx does, again, like what RuPaul did for drag. It's opening a door for a world of new possibilities within the LGBT community in regards to theatrical performing. But that was my take on drag within theater, and a sort of kind of summarized, but not really summarized, take on drag within theater and how long it's actually been going on for, and people really shouldn't be surprised or anything, like, Jesus. But yes, we're back, no longer Riesling and Raven. We are now the Sequin Playbill. I hope y'all enjoyed. I hope y'all learned something. And I hope you guys stick around for future episodes. Like I said, I have already begun the planning stages and schedule of future topics and everything. I am very excited to get into some of these episodes, like LGBT musicals about the AIDS epidemic and whatnot for AIDS Awareness Month. I've got some episodes specifically in relation to like Halloween, going back to school. I got stuff around like when Oscars comes out. I'm actually genuinely excited about these episodes, and I hope you guys stick around and continue to listen. I am not taking down my older episodes when it was Riesling and Raven. They are all very still entertaining, informative, and more personal. Now it's just going to mostly be theater and drag from an not outside perspective, but like a more educational perspective rather than just personal. I may throw in like personal elements here and there, but it is more going to be on the elements of drag and the elements of theater. And I will be doing lists again, because I love doing them, like my favorite like female forward songs and artists, POC drag queens and actors on the stage. For Asian Heritage Month, my favorite like Asian lead actors and queens and kings. I'll be discussing a whole bunch of things. Come Canada Day, I will be going into Come From Away, and this is just going to be a newly more concentrated yet organized podcast, which is kind of what I wanted to do in the first place. So I'm hoping you guys stick around. I hope you guys enjoy. I hope you guys learn some things. And I guess that is curtain on my first episode under the Sequin Playbill. Have a good day!